Welcome to the Good Health is Good Business Show, the show focused on a healthy workforce as a competitive advantage. And now, our hosts, Dr. David Rierich and Stephen Cherniak.
That's us.
We're on, and it's good to be back in the studio. We missed last week.
We did.
But we were busy. We were out there in the consulting world trying to help companies reduce their health care benefits.
And keeping their employees healthy.
That's right, and that's what pays the bills.
But this is fun.
This is where we belong.
The tag
like team that. Of Dr. R and Steve.
That's right. And I have a feeling today's show is going to be the best one this week.
It's going to be an exciting show because on the show today, we have one of the most exciting people you're ever going to meet. Andrew Sykes, he's an actuary, and you know how exciting actuaries can be.
I can't wait.
Yep, we'll get into that.
In addition to Andrew, we'll have our news of the week and a health tip segment as well. But first, I think we ought to introduce our sponsor, which is WellFit Advantage. WellFit Advantage is a new and innovative and proactive health enhancement program. It integrates seamlessly into a company's benefit program to help get employees to participate, as well as include rewards for healthy lifestyle decisions.
That's right. Engagement, that's the name of the game.
It works to help build a culture of wellness and support, which is important to a healthy and a successful company.
That's right.
It does fit for all employers, large and small, and it integrates with their benefit program as a unique approach to doing that, and we thank them for supporting the show. And for more information on the WellFit Advantage program, just go to www.wellfitadvantage.com.
All right.
Okay. So news.
So go ahead. You can start.
Yep. I have a hero, another Good Health is Good Business hero that I wanted to recognize.
Lee, could we have the drum roll?
Besides you, Dr. Rierich, obviously you're my hero. But also I want to recognize Muskogee, Oklahoma, City Council.
Wait, I know this.
Do you?
Yeah, that's an Okie from Muskogee.
Well, it's Muskogee, Okie. But they created a wellness committee within the City Council to work in improving the healthy lifestyles among the citizens of Muskogee. Now, why would they want to try and create a healthier community like that?
This is the City Council?
This is the City Council created a separate wellness committee specifically designed to look at the citizens of Muskogee and help improve their lifestyle. Yep. Because they've recognized that Oklahoma is in the bottom five of states in terms of overall citizens' health.
Well, we should do a follow-up story on this in a year from now.
We're going to get the mayor and the lead coordinator on the show because they place a strong emphasis on – here's what I like. They placed a strong emphasis on public education with billboards around the town, television commercials to increase awareness of the need to shift from unhealthy lifestyles to healthy lifestyles. Their main target in 2010 is tobacco use among college students. So I guess they're local colleges there in Muskogee. Meeting with area colleges to meet the goal of a smoke-free campuses by January 2011. They've partnered with the Muskogee Farmers Market to promote fruits and vegetables there. They sponsor community gardens within the city parks, schools, and churches as well. We can't forget physical activity. They worked with the Muskogee Swim and Fitness Center to sponsor events to help improve and include community walks in the downtown area and city parks as well.
And actually, this is really a good story because, it is a community-based effort.
It has to be.
It has to be.
I mean, it's got to get, although the worksite is its own community, and that's been basically our main focus.
Right.
But the family is the core, and then the community that you live in 16 hours out of the day that you're not at the office as well.
Yeah.
And what I like as well, and including businesses, they're implementing a certified healthy business program to be recognized by the council as well. So they're incorporating their whole community.
Well, let's get them on the show.
Muskogee Wellness Initiative. Congratulations.
All right. Well, I'm next. And the interesting article today in today's Wall Street Journal about how many individuals are balking at the cost of prescriptions and not picking up their prescriptions that their doctors prescribe.
Because they're too much money.
They are. They're too much money. And what do you think is the percentage of people who just don't pick up the prescriptions that have been phoned in? Take a guess.
45%.
No, it's not that high. It's only about 1 out of 10. But the increase is jumped over the last couple of years by about 55%. Okay, and mainly it's because people are in these high deductible plans, and when they go to the pharmacy and find out that their asthma inhaler and their Lipitor is going to cost them $400, and they have to pay for that, they say, "Oh, wow." So it'll be interesting to get Andrew's view on this, because I know he's big into high deductible health plans, so we'll question him on that when we bring him on the show. But I do think that's a bad sign that people aren't picking up their prescriptions.
So how do you follow up on that? Is there any way then that the physician, although waiting till the next visit to say, hey, is the medication working? And they sheepishly say, you know what, I didn't bother to get it.
Yeah. No, listen, what we do and what I would recommend is a little more value-based pharmacy design. So if you know what's driving your health care cost, and you can tell that by looking at the data if you have access to it like you should, then you can actually make these medications that are required to be taken every day to control a disease, put them in a lower tier, put them at a zero copay, do something, but get people on their medicines. We manage disease with medicines today.
Yeah. All right, and then the last news story I didn't want to forget, because this is the true picture of America. Many Americans, the headline is, many Americans don't even know they're fat. Many Americans have skewed perceptions when it comes to their weight, often believing they're thinner than they really are. And we know this when we do health risk assessments within companies. And every health risk assessment has a question in it asking them to rate their health. What do you think your health is today? Poor, fair, good, excellent are
right.
The basic four. And normally it's about 4% of the population identify themselves as being fair to poor. And most, 96%, saying good to excellent. And we know that's not true. And this is a similar survey where they asked people their height and weight, and were able to figure out their BMI. And they asked, okay, what classification would you put yourself in? Correct, mm-hmm. Regular weight, overweight, obese, and such. 30% of those in the overweight class believe they were actually normal size, while 70% of those classified as obese felt they were simply overweight. And among the heaviest group, the morbidly obese, almost 60% pegged themselves as obese, while another 39% of the morbidly obese considered themselves just merely overweight.
Yeah.
So if you're not able to recognize that you have a problem, right? Nothing's going to happen. No initiation's going to occur.
Well, you know, it's the theory of relativity. You compare yourself to your neighbors, and when 70% of people are overweight, you don't think you are.
You're right. Well, and that's the point as well. Now overweight is becoming the new norm. We know that, right? 66% of the population's overweight. A third of it is obese as well.
Let's just forget these terms, overweight and obese, and just call these people fat.
And when they asked them what they felt, why they were heavier, okay, what would you say their answer was? They had two choices. Were you heavier because you weren't getting enough exercise, or are you heavier because of your poor eating habits?
Because they don't exercise.
That's it. That was the most common question. That was the most common answer. They didn't think their consumption of food was a problem. It was because they weren't exercising enough.
But Biggie sized me.
That's right. It's a Biggie size world.
Yep.
And of the weight loss interventions, what do they think would be the most successful?
The employer installing an on-site fitness facility.
No, surgery.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Fix me, heal me.
It's a good reason not to cover bariatric surgery.
Give me.
All you HR executives out there.
Give me the quick fix. Okay.
All right. So that's the end of that segment.
I'm Katie Bell, partner with the Gallup Organization, and you're listening to the Good Health is Good Business Show, the show focused on a healthy workforce as a competitive advantage.
Okay, we are back with the segment of the show where we have our featured guest, and today's guest is Andrew Sykes, Chairman of Health at Work. He is a qualified actuary, a licensed health insurance broker, and a managed health professional and accomplished speaker on many topics including what I referenced earlier, consumer-directed healthcare and wellness. Andrew is a fellow of the Faculty of Actuaries. He has worked with many Fortune 500 companies and was also served as Chief Wellness Officer for the Vitality Group before starting his own company, Health at Work. Mm-hmm. Andrew, it's nice to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Andrew, so tell us a little bit about Health at Work, the company, and what makes your firm unique in the wellness arena.
Well, firstly, we're not a wellness company. We're a consulting firm, so we don't have wellness products to sell.
Mm-hmm.
What distinguishes us is captured in our name, Health at Work, and that's the belief that what's wrong with our health in the U.S. is either caused by or blamed on how we work. So if you consider that half of our awake adult lifetimes we spend at or on work, and we usually blame work as the reason why we eat badly or don't have enough time to exercise or are stressed out, it's not unfair to say that it's work that's making us sick. So we're of the view that if you want to solve this problem, you need to find ways to make work itself healthy, hence the name Health at Work. We're actuaries and behavioral psychologists by education, and that gives us a lens to look at traditional wellness solutions that's a little different from the normal, or if you like, the common sense view.
Mm-hmm.
And when we apply these mathematical lenses or the scientific approach to the question of what works and what doesn't, we found we get some very surprising answers. And so they're not generally popular answers, because much of what we have to say is that many of the traditional tools that are used in wellness are at best ineffective, and in some cases we think they're downright harmful.
Hmm.
Health risk assessments are a case in point.
Then that's the one I was going to...
So that's a little bit about our company. We typically only work with organizations like school districts or large employers who answer two questions as yes. Question one is, are you serious about improving the health of your employees and your customers? And question two is, are you prepared to make wellness a key part of the strategy for how you drive your business success, not just a tactic for reducing healthcare costs?
Great. That's fantastic. Those are key questions, because we continually try to say that most of the time, if we can get to the CFO and CEO and say, this is a business strategy, and that's the way it needs to be looked at, with the same effort and resources that you might put into moving into a new market, launching a new product, or taking on a merger or acquisition, then you're probably down the right track.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, I'm curious, because I'm a data person, and obviously as an actuary, you have to be a data person too, and data for me drives most of my decisions. But data oftentimes shows us what we assume to be the truth is oftentimes not the truth, and you've commented on that. So tell us how the data, when you look at an employee's, you know, the medical and pharmacy claim data, how does it change your opinions on what you recommend?
Got it. I agree that the data is where you should look for the answer to the question, does this work or does that work? And I must distinguish between two types of data. The one is the stories we hear of the individuals whose lives were completely turned around in response to knowing their numbers, for example. And that's real data, but the data I'm talking about is also what happens for the majority of people. And much like the news you were talking about earlier of people having answered on a health risk assessment that they view their health to be good or excellent, when mm-hmm. in reality, two-thirds of us as Americans are overweight, something like 20% of Americans have diabetes or high blood pressure or high cholesterol, then it's really clear that what we hear from people and what is the truth about people can be quite different.
Right.
So when we look at the data of, for example, the effectiveness of biometric screens as a tool for reducing healthcare costs, we see that more often than not, in the year following biometric screens, the costs of healthcare go up, not down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that that's because knowing your numbers isn't useful, But I am saying that what usually happens following a biometric screening is that a lot of people who have unidentified high blood pressure, for example, take what is to them the next logical step, which is going to their physician and getting medication. And you often see a spike in drug costs immediately following a widespread, well-attended biometric screening. Mm-hmm. Now, you may say, well, that's good news because rather we should have people who are being treated for diabetes or high blood pressure than not, because it'll be a savings in the long term. And that's true. But often employers and health plans take quite a short-term view, and if they're looking for that early return on investment, the best way to get it is not doing biometric screenings.
Good point, and it's our job as consultants to be sure they understand that, because you're right. They so often think that that's going to save them money, and it doesn't.
So getting back to the issue about HRAs, or one of the points both in what you said briefly earlier and also in some of the literature you sent us, the HRAs can be a waste of time or can be dangerous, but you did hint on biometric testing providing some valuable information. So what approach from assessing a company do you recommend for your clients?
Well, let's start with the HRAs. Our view is that almost every employer has a very limited budget of money and resources to spend on the issue of wellness. And that one of the pieces of advice we give them as actuaries is to rank the effectiveness of the different approaches they can take in decreasing order of bang for their buck. Mm-hmm. And HRAs, while they provide some information, generally tell you what you already know about your population. And I've seen so many employers use the HRA under the assumption that it will provide this understanding of the health risks faced by their employees, without which they couldn't build a valuable or effective wellness program. But at the end of the process, the wellness program always looks the same. And in fact, all wellness programs at their heart look the same. They ask people to do three things mainly: exercise every day, eat well, and if I can steal Michael Pollan's phrase, eat food, mostly plants, I would add in freshly harvested and not too much, and don't use drugs more than is necessary. Those are the three habits at the heart of every successful wellness program. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that HRAs, from an employer's point of view, give you a biased sample of people's own view of their health, which, as you said earlier on your segment, is far from the truth. And it's not a necessary tool in building an effective wellness program. So better spend the money on the program themselves than on a diagnostic tool that, in our view, doesn't add any value. Now, that just argues for why HRAs might be useless.
Right.
We also think they have a dark side, which is the act of writing down or answering questions related to your health in a way where you know what the answers should be, and sometimes, frankly, you're even encouraged by an incentive to answer the right way, leaves many people answering, for example, the question, how many drinks did you have last week, as two or three, because they know the right answer is close to zero. They may remember that the truth is closer to 20 or 30, but they have this feeling that they're being watched by their employers oftentimes, despite their assurances of confidentiality. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not such a problem in and of itself. What is a problem is that people leave the experience of completing an HRA, believing their answers as their new truth. And so many people leave an HRA with a self-offered license to continue behaving badly from a health point of view. And so there are those few people who leave and change their life on a dime, but mostly people leave the HRA experience with less intention of changing their health habits rather than with more. And the judge for us of whether a wellness tool is effective or an engagement tool is effective is whether or not it gets people to do those three things that I spoke about earlier: exercise more, eat better, and use only the minimum amount of prescription drugs.
Andrew, let me ask you this question.
I know you, go ahead.
Because I wouldn't disagree with you on most of your points, but how would you answer the question that the HRA's value is primarily to get a snapshot of the population so you can track it annually from year to year and see how you might be changing the health risks within the population. Is there a better way to do it than the HRA?
I believe so. What you're tracking with the HRA is not the health of the population. It's the people's view of their health. And as you said earlier with your statement about the theory of relativity, if the population as a whole is becoming more and more obese, and you look around you and you compare yourselves to others, as we know that people do, what you might find is that people's perception of their health improves over time, despite the population as a whole getting less and less healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of that, and I would argue that with the demographic information of a workforce and 10 minutes, an actuary or someone skilled with the numbers could give you a better estimate of the health status of your organization than you'll get from an HRA. In our view, though, that the thing to measure is the positive side of health in a way that is verifiable and not based on people's own opinions. By positive health, I mean the evidence that people's health is improving rather than the evidence that their risk might fail. Let me give you an example. In our view, somebody's fitness score, measured by their submax VO2 score or some other way that you might measure their fitness, is a much more powerful predictor of productivity and future healthcare costs than are their biometric scores of cholesterol, high blood pressure, or blood sugar level. We are in the practice of assuming that the best way to measure health is by measuring health failures, and we could use health insurance premiums as a proxy for that, or health risks, which we get from a biometric screen. But we don't really measure the positive aspects of health, and primarily I'm referring to fitness. And if you look at the data that compares these different types of health measures with the productivity that comes from changes in them, it's clear that a change in fitness level buys you a lot more as an employer than does a change in cholesterol level.
Well, now, I've got to tell you that Steve keeps on smiling because if he says exercise is medicine one more time, we're all going to shoot him.
I don't have to.
So,
Andrew did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
But how do you measure that? You can't. I don't see a practical way of measuring individual fitness within a large population. How do you track that?
Well, it's no more difficult than a biometric screen. In fact, it's a little easier, and there are perhaps 20 ways of measuring fitness. I'll give you a few examples. One way is using the so-called Oxford 3-minute step test, which involves someone walking up and down on a 16-inch step for 3 minutes and comparing their heart rate before and after that small exercise, putting it into a formula, and it gives you a measure for their submaximal VO2, which is a measure of how quickly or how effectively your lungs process the oxygen that we breathe. Mm-hmm. And that's a measure of how cardiovascularly fit you are.
Mm-hmm.
There are other ways of doing it. Organizations like Polar and Suunto and others that make these heart rate monitors have ways of measuring your fitness. It turns out that they're much less invasive than a blood test, about a quarter of the cost, and they take about the same time or in some cases half the time. So it's entirely practical to measure fitness, and in our view, why it's a superior measure is because it's a much stronger predictor of productivity than is a health risk, for example.
Yeah, there are bike tests. There's walking tests as well.
As a physician, I'm familiar with the treadmill, the Omax test, but that just doesn't seem practical. So
right. From a group setting, as Andrew mentioned, there's step tests that you can do and do more than one person at a time in that type of setting to do it. There are walking tests, a mile test, mile and a half test as well that can be used in measuring fitness through their heart rate response for it.
Are there groups to do that? Are there vendors that will come in and do that?
Oh, yeah, sure. But let's take it a little step further and talk about behavior change and what it really takes to change behavior then. Within a population to do that. So what type of program recommendations do you find you making with your clients, say, in terms of improving their fitness level? Any examples?
So we distinguish between behavior change and habits change. Mm-hmm. Behavior change is you used to smoke and now you don't because of an external force applied, which might be an incentive or it might be a smoking ban or something else. A habit change has occurred once that behavior change persists after the force is removed. Now, in our experience, things like incentives and wellness programs can be somewhat effective at changing behaviors. But rewards in particular have themselves a dark side, which is that when they're removed, or if they're not increased substantially over time, they tend to lose their power. And if you watch how people behave after a reward is removed, often they revert to their previous bad habits with a vengeance. And so we would say that in most cases, to get real results in a corporate wellness program, you have to aim for the higher standard of habit change, not just behavior change. Mm-hmm. Now, that begs the question, well, how do you change people's habits effectively if rewards, for example, aren't the most effective tool? And we've studied what it is that it really drives people's habits, and it turns out that our habits are explained much more by the habits of the people around us and much more by the environment in which we live, learn, and work than it is by rewards, our own personal motivation, our education level, or anything to do with traditional wellness programs themselves. So in our view, the strongest or most effective way of bringing about change in habits at the workplace is creating peer support systems, or if you like, in different language, champions programs that get a critical mass of individuals to take on changing their health habits and inviting others to join them. So it's something as simple as having someone in a group of four or five friends taking a stand for having walking meetings at lunch, or leading the group in ordering from the healthy salad bar down the road rather than from the fast food joint with the high-fat burgers. And it's amazing to watch how just one person in a group of four or five can make a material change that all the incentives, health coaches, and online learning and wellness tools have failed to make. So in our view, if you're going to solve this problem, the way to do it is through the people at work and by the people at work rather than from an external wellness company or from an HR request or bribe to participate in a program. Mm-hmm.
That is a common theme that we preach frequently. You cannot rely on an external vendor to change the culture of your internal structure and organization.
And providing a supportive work environment is one of the main focuses and main pillars of a successful, healthy company. Mm-hmm. Well, Andrew...
And I think that word culture is key. I don't think it's as hard as people believe to create a culture of wellness at work. And that a culture of wellness doesn't look like having some healthy options in the vending machine. It looks like only having healthy food available at work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that.
And it doesn't look like having a wellness program that people may participate in. It looks like having exercise as something that's easy at work and, frankly, expected at work.
Total agreement. From here in the studio, Andrew.
We've ordered our treadmill desk at work. I love that idea.
Andrew, we always ask our guests the same question, and that is, have you found to be the most successful engagement strategy to get members involved in health and wellness? I think I might know the answer based on your previous response, but we like to get what our experts are saying in terms of that area. So what have you found to be the most successful engagement strategy to get members participating in health and wellness?
Got it. Well, I'll give you one of the keys that we found, and it may sound strange, but it's making wellness at work allowable. And it takes some explanation that. Mm-hmm. We found that almost always, somewhere in the line management or in the organizational chart, is a head of a department who says, despite what HR is asking you to participate in, you've got customers, deadlines, or projects that you need to work on. And either directly or by their behavior, they remove people's permission to be healthy at work. So we found that paying managers for the health of their employees to make the message clear that one of the things we ask you to do is not only get your department's job work done, but one of the things we ask you to do is make sure that you have a healthy team, because a healthy team drives productivity. So we've found bonus systems for line managers based on the average, for example, fitness of their team has been a very effective way to get the job done.
Oh, I like that.
And how many clients buy into that? Is it a significant number, or is it still a very small number that you're finding?
I would say they all buy into it intellectually.
Right.
And about one-third of them do it in the first year, and one-third of them do it in the second year, and one-third of them are still not doing it at all. They mm-hmm. use other techniques that we have for driving engagement.
Right.
Okay. But you asked me for a key one, and so I was thinking of the one that is most often left out of traditional engagement programs, and so that's the one I chose.
Yeah, and we appreciate that. It is a good one, and driving and putting in terms of basically job responsibility,
right.
from a supervisor and managerial level. Love it. Mm. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us on the show. I'm sure and I know that we have a lot more that we could be discussing and talking about, and possibly having you back on a future show to continue that discussion.
And I'm sure some of our listeners would also like to learn a little bit more about the services that you offer. So what is the easiest way for any of our listeners to get a hold of you or learn more about your consulting services?
They can find a brief summary of what we do at our website, which is hatwork.com, or my personal preference is to find me on LinkedIn, my name Andrew Sykes, spelled Sykes, or to contact us by phone. My cell number is 312-890-3323, and we're more than happy to talk to anyone interested in furthering our mission of improving the health of Americans.
Great. Right. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Andrew.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, so there. How many times have we told HR managers that they should have in their merit increase program how well middle line managers and how well they actually improve the health status of their population?
I know. It's taking it, though, at such a higher level and a commitment that if you can get a company committed to a point like that, is the culture and a supportive environment just follows.
You know, and Andrew Sykes also, I think he reiterated in his own words something that we've heard from other experts, which is it's not participation that we should strive for. It's a commitment, all right? So he broke it down, and it's not behavior change, but it's habit change.
Mm-hmm.
The commitment has to come from the individual.
And the habit comes from the supportive environment that you're in.
That's
and the
right.
people around you. Yep. Well, we need to wrap up.
Okay.
So we want to thank our sponsor, WellFit Advantage, a new and innovative proactive health enhancement program. And we encourage our listeners to check out more about the WellFit Advantage program for any company, large and small, and simply go to www.wellfitadvantage.com. We want to thank Andrew Sykes for joining us, and to learn more about his company and services, simply go to hatwork.com, www.hatwork.com.
That's right. And next week we have an interesting guest coming on, Laura Carabello with the Medical Travel Today Society.
Talking about what's becoming a more and more common practice of medical tourism.
That's
going
right.
overseas for your medical care.
Yeah.
And we also want to remind our listeners of our upcoming Dr. Rerichs and my presentation at the Atlanta SHRM Conference. That's on October 19th at the Cobb Galleria. And we'll be talking about and bringing the best of Good Health is Good Business to our presentation. That's wellness program engagement strategies. and we'll be sharing what our guests have been telling us are those best engagement strategies for the workforce.
And all those attendees who attend our lecture will get a free CD with a listing of engagement strategies by all of our guests.
And for more information, go to the SHRM Atlanta website, which is www.shrmatlanta, so that's S-H-R-M, the word Atlanta.org. And to talk to us, simply send us any communication about the show, about health information, about strategies, and you can do that by sending a note to Dr. Dave, Dr. Dave, at healthybusinessradio.com, or Steve at healthybusinessradio.com.
And our challenge question for today is who wrote and sang this? Well, who sang the song, I'm an Okie from Muskogee?
Okay. Thank you for that, Dave. And so until next time, we're keeping you on target. We're online and on demand at www.healthybusinessradio.com. Until next week,
good health is good business. Everybody.